Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What forces drive people to flee their homes and countries in fear for their lives, and how can safer places and how can safer places share the burdens of caring for refugees and asylum seekers? The United Nations High Commission on Refugees reported 42.5 million people forcibly displaced from their homes worldwide at the end of last year, including a record 800,000 forced to flee across borders. The result has been called human suffering on an epic scale and presents both short-term crises and long-term challenges for those displaced and for governments, economies, and NGOs in regions where they seek shelter. Alexander Betts joins us to talk about all this. He is university lecturer in refugee and forced migration studies at the Department of International Development at the University of Oxford and a contributing author to the UNHCR's report on the state of the world's refugees. He's also director of the newly founded Humanitarian Innovation Project funded by Dallasites Stephanie and Hunter Hunt. He's in town to address the Tower Center and the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity at SMU on refugees, technology, and the private sector. Alex, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
So the UN is particularly worried about 33.9 million people who do not have the full protection of their state. What does that mean?
Of the 43.5 million people that you've mentioned, many are refugees recognized under international law as fleeing across an international border because of persecution. And they're the people who have a legal entitlement to refugee status, to get asylum, to cross a border, and be given rights by the host country that they find themselves in. Those people, however, are only about 12 million of that total number. So we've got about 12 million refugees. And then we've got a whole host of other people in refugee-like situations who are fleeing very serious levels of human rights violations, very difficult situations, but might, for instance, not have crossed an international border or might be fleeing a natural disaster or an environmental cause of movement rather than persecution by a repressive government or rather than a conflict or war. So amongst that number, you've got internally displaced people, people who haven't crossed an international border but might still be fleeing very desperate situations. In Colombia, for instance, the conflict there has driven huge numbers of internally displaced people. In Sudan, with the Darfur crisis, we see lots of people who are still in Sudan and are still fleeing very desperate situations. And one of the other big challenges that falls outside that traditional refugee framework is natural disaster. In the context of climate change in particular, there's change in the natural environment, we get desertification, we get short-term rapid onset crises like famines and droughts that lead to increasing numbers of people leaving their homes. But the big challenge is that many of those other people outside the 12 million refugees don't always have a clear entitlement to rights in the same way that refugees do.
And that can be a hard thing to prove if one is seeking official refugee or asylum status.
Absolutely. Even if you're one of those 12 million people who's leaving persecution by a repressive government, even if you're leaving one of the worst repressive governments in the world, like a North Korea or Myanmar or even Darfur, if you cross an international border, you have to go through a pretty rigorous bureaucratic and administrative procedure to show you are a refugee. And in some countries, bearing in mind that over 70% of the world's refugees are in impoverished developing countries, the neighboring countries to these very desperate countries, you have a situation where they have very limited capacity to screen people and say, this person's a refugee, this person's not a refugee. And governments have a process called refugee status determination. And it can take 2, 3, even more years to establish that you are a legitimate, genuine refugee. And you undergo that process as a process of deep scrutiny. And you've got to make credible your claim. So as an individual fleeing persecution, you might have to describe in great detail your family's experiences, what you've been through, why it is that you as an individual, because of your ethnic background, because of your nationality, because you're from a particular minority group or social group, face a credible threat of persecution.
I think, Alex, that figure, that 70% ending up in developing countries, even as they seek refuge, might take a lot of people in the developed West by surprise. We are aware that Europe receives some of these folks. We are aware that we receive some of them. I think a lot of Americans may not realize that the countries who are taking these people in, the vast majority of them, are in only slightly a better position to care for them.
We really think of refugees as a problem, and we think of large numbers of refugees coming to our countries in the West. In Europe, for instance, lots of asylum seekers arrive spontaneously. From Africa, for instance, they cross the Mediterranean, often paying smugglers or traffickers to bring them to Europe, and they're seen as part of the migration problem. Mm-hmm. And there's a view that we receive huge numbers of people. In the US, there's a slightly different tradition of how refugees arrive in the United States compared to Europe. Rather than people spontaneously having to get there, the US has historically been extremely generous in resettling people, going to refugee camps in the developing world and identifying the most vulnerable and transporting them directly to the US and helping them integrate in cities across the country in a wide variety of states. But when refugees are very visible in Dallas and Fort Worth, for instance, there are huge communities of refugees, we assume that most of them are rescued from
taken
their very
care of. Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That we give them assistance here. But of course, the reality is very different, that's just a very small fraction of those who are in need. And the overwhelming majority of refugees are actually in the neighboring countries that they've come from, that most Somalis are actually across the border in Kenya or Ethiopia, that most people who flee Afghanistan are actually in the neighboring countries of Pakistan or Iran, that the Congolese that flee the Democratic Republic of Congo tend to just cross the border into Tanzania, that the majority aren't actually coming to us, to the United States, to Europe, but that's a tiny fraction of some of the most vulnerable, in some cases, that are resettled, or actually, in some cases, some of the most able, who have the ability and means to travel further distances beyond their region of origin. And it's worth bearing in mind that those countries that receive the largest number of refugees are often those least able to take care of those refugees. They're the poorest developing countries. And countries like Kenya now host over 500,000 Somali refugees. And that number's increased with the famine and drought of last year in the Horn of Africa. And it's a staggering responsibility for relatively poor countries to have to take.
Another thing, Alex, that I think it's overlooked is the fact that the vast majority of refugees, if given a choice, would much prefer to go home than go elsewhere. And if they have some mobility back and forth, would love the opportunity even to visit the places they come from.
Well, I mean, we sometimes assume that refugees are like other migrants, that they just want to move for a better life, that they want to move, for instance, to the United States and get access to jobs and improve the lives of their families. And of course, any human being likes to better their life and their family's life. But with refugees, nobody chooses to become a refugee. And many of them would like to go home if they possibly could, if there was the option to return to their own families, to their homes, to their communities and cultures, many would ultimately choose that option. But the reality is that many conflicts go on for 5, 10, 15 years. Many repressive governments hold on to power for a very long time. And so you get large populations caught in refugee camps outside their country of origin for long periods of time. And this is one of the most striking characteristics of the refugee issue. It's a problem known as protracted refugee situations, where people end up in closed camps, often in border areas that can be very remote, insecure, that are characterized by being desert locations, where people don't have the right to work, often have restrictions on their freedom of movement, and yet they simply cannot go home. And so they end up stuck in those situations for very long periods of time with very restricted human rights conditions, without the ability to move, the ability to communicate freely with their families who may be dispersed across other camps or elsewhere in the world. And that challenge of protracted refugee situations is one in which refugees who often desperately want to go home can't, but they can't be resettled to another country because resettlement figures are generally low and there's a limit to how many people can be moved to third countries, and it creates a real human catastrophe. Protracted refugee situations and refugee camps have been described by the United States Committee for Refugees and Immigrants as warehousing. Mm. It's effectively putting people in a confined area and leaving them there for 5, 10, 15 years. And you also have children whose parents have moved to refugee camps, who were born in those camps, who grew up in those camps, who never know anything very different and have very restricted access to educational opportunities, and their world is that. And many of those people do want to go home, but simply can't. And so the question becomes, what's the alternative? Surely there's a way in which we can look beyond leaving people in camps for the long term, and we can empower them as individuals.
So tell us what humanitarian innovation is.
Humanitarian innovation, in the way I conceive it, is a way of fundamentally reconceiving the paradigm of how we protect vulnerable people, and in this case, particularly refugees. If we think about innovation, it's often a concept that can be assumed to be about novelty, but it's different from invention, which is creating something new. Innovation for me is about taking something that might have been applied in a very different context and simply adapting it to a new context. You can take something very simple, like some technology around solar power or a basic application for a smartphone. And simply by transferring it to a new context, you can fundamentally change it and give it a new use. Now, in the humanitarian context, humanitarian actors like the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UN's refugee agency, have often done things in a particular way because that's how they've always done them. Mm-hmm. But if we think about humanitarianism, as well as being about doing good things to help people in desperate situations, it's a series of subsectors. It's about shelter. It's about health, water, sanitation and hygiene. It's about nutrition, internet and communications technology. And in all of those areas, there are a lot of lessons that can be learned, best practices, ways in which other people elsewhere may be trying things that haven't yet been applied to the refugee context. There may be a whole host of research and development innovations that are going on in the private sector, in other humanitarian contexts, that simply aren't captured. But if we understood them, we might be able to apply them and pilot them and prototype them in the refugee context to make people's lives better.
What's the balance between taking those ideas that emerge from sort of the top down as compared with those that come from the bottom up, from refugees themselves who think, okay, this is a better way to keep the roof on my shelter or to make sure that my kids have clean drinking water, that sort of thing?
This is a great question, because it's very challenging to go outwards to the outside world and say, well, we've got a host of ideas in the private sector, a host of technologies that work very well in the United States. But when we go to a different context with a different group of people with different cultures and different backgrounds who are often part of the bottom billion in the world in very desperate situations, it's a very different context. And so I think the real challenge and what we're trying to do in the Hunt Humanitarian Innovation Project that we've set up at Oxford University is bring the bottom up and the top down together to say, yes, we've got a wide variety of potential untapped solutions, but our starting point has to be looking at refugees as individuals, engaging in dialogue and partnership with those people to understand how they currently engage with technology, innovation, and the private sector at the very local level. Because refugees, by definition, have to survive in difficult contexts. Mm. Necessity is the mother of invention. People who are in desperate situations and need to support their families find ways of doing that. So if we can understand their skills, their aspirations, their hopes, and match those with outside ideas, we can make real progress by bringing refugee voices and their innovation together with other ideas from the outside.
My guest is Alexander Betts. He's University Lecturer in Refugee and Forced Migration Studies in the Department of International Development at Oxford. He's also Director of the Humanitarian Innovation Project, and he'll speak at SMU this afternoon. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alexander Betz. He's University Lecturer in Refugee and Forced Migration Studies in the Department of International Development at Oxford and Director of the Humanitarian Innovation Project. He's in town to address the Tower Center and the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity at SMU. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think at kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Alex, how do the fates of refugees differ depending on whether they are in an official camp setting or they are sort of refugees on an ad hoc basis trying to make their way in, say, an urban setting?
Traditionally, we think of refugees as being in urban locations, either refugee camps or settlements where the international community or NGOs or international organizations will protect them with money donated by donor governments. That's changing rapidly. In the world in general, there's a process of urbanization. More and more people are moving to cities, and refugees are part of that trend. Many people are not content to stay passively in camps or settlements, but move to cities. And today, over half of the world's refugees are actually living in urban areas. They're in cities like Bogota, Johannesburg, Amman, Nairobi, and their situation is surprisingly different. In many host countries in the developing world, the governments put restrictions on people's movements. They insist that if you want assistance, you have to stay in the refugee camp. So by moving to an urban area, refugees take on a huge amount of responsibility to look after themselves and their families, to find work, to find shelter, and cater for their most basic needs. That effectively means that rather than relying on the protection of international organizations, they're engaging in self-protection. And it's incredible how much resilience and agency people have to support themselves. But nevertheless, that can mean that in urban areas, the situation of refugees varies dramatically, from people who are extremely impoverished, extremely destitute, through to those that can set up businesses, even in the informal sector, below the radar. Mm-hmm. So for instance, not too long ago, I was in Nairobi in Kenya, and there's an area called the Eastleigh Estate, where you have hundreds of thousands of Somalis, some who are registered as refugees, others who have moved there informally through family connections. And some of those Somali families are running huge businesses or engaging in the local markets and have transnational links where their families send them money and they use that as seed money to set up businesses. Others are living 10 people in a family in one or two rooms in a really poor quality apartment. And so the circumstances of those in cities is obviously very different in many cases to the classic camp where you might see tent-like structures or basic brick housing, and people are often way out in rural areas. If they're lucky, people might have the chance to grow crops next to a home in a camp, but more often than not, they'll be dependent upon humanitarian aid, both for food and their non-food needs like shelter.
Being in a situation like that for 5 or 10 or 15 years sounds like the surest possible way, on top of the trauma they've already suffered, to sort of deflate a person's confidence in his or her ability to be self-sufficient.
Yeah. I mean, it's really striking how much resilience refugees have. But any human being's resilience has limits and can be eroded over time. When I was in a refugee camp in Djibouti, I met a refugee called Wooly. And Wooly had been in that particular camp since 1988. And he'd lived out his entire adult life in those circumstances. And what he told me was, man doesn't live on food and water alone, but on hope. And he kept that flame of hope burning simply by playing a role in the community. And in the absence of secondary education, he had a tent with a chalkboard and chalk, and he had the kids come through and he taught them. And he said that his hope had been shattered, but he was trying to sustain it for the next generation by contributing so that they might have the hope of being resettled, going elsewhere, and having the educational opportunities that he'd been deprived of. And I think that's an example of the sheer determination and resilience, but the fact that if you can imagine yourself in a situation where your movement is restricted, you're far from your family, you're separated from what you know, and you simply can't work whatever aspirations you have, they're going to be thwarted by the reality of the situation. At some point, that becomes shattering to your confidence, and it leads to dependency. And that dependency is something that's so unnecessary, because refugees come often with huge skills. They've often had good educations, training. They can be doctors, lawyers, nurses, and want to work and want to contribute to their societies, but they're left in limbo. And that situation doesn't benefit anybody. It's a drain on resources. And I think there are different ways in which we could conceive of that to enable people to live more sustainably and ensure that they maintain that hope that my friend Wooley had described.
So how would the application of the things you're learning about humanitarian innovation be useful for someone like Wooley?
I think what we want to conceive of is a totally new way of thinking about the refugee issue. Up to now, the basic logic behind humanitarian assistance in general and refugee protection in particular is it's led by governments and states. And money provided by donor governments is transferred to international organizations or NGOs to support people and protect them on their behalf.
So it's like, sit tight, we'll take care of you and figure it out.
Exactly, Chris. Mm-hmm. It's, we'll take care of you. But over a long period of time, that's a form of welfarism. It's a form of social security, if you like, on an international scale. And that's simply not sustainable because it's pouring money down a black hole. And of course, it's necessary to some extent to have that form of state-provided government protection, but it's simply not enough. So in the Humanitarian Innovation Project, what we're trying to do is say, well, maybe there's another way. Maybe there's a way in which rather than crowding out a role for the private sector, we can embrace the private sector as a source of not only new ways of doing things, but sustainable ways in which resources can provide the assistance and protection that's currently being provided by the state. Even at the very local grassroots level, refugees, when given an opportunity, create their own work and livelihood opportunities. We see them setting up businesses on every scale. We see them innovating. And if they could get the support in terms of mentorship, in terms of skills training, in terms of basic access to capital and microfinance that could allow them to grow their ideas and their businesses, well, then people don't have to be seen as a burden. They can be a real benefit and an asset to their host communities and their host governments. And that's something that can be really transformative. So what we want to do is, through the research that we bring, understand what's going on at the very local level, what refugees are already doing to build their own lives, and then try and draw on a group of outside people who can be drawn in to offer sources of innovation, skills training, funding, to really nurture that resilience and that innovation at the grassroots level and empower refugees to take control of their own destinies and contribute to the host communities they're in, rather than saying, wait tight, it may have been 15 or 20 years, but one day you'll be free to go back. At that point, it's too late. We could have been using that human capital as a resource that improves the refugees' lives, improves the host communities that they're in, and leads to real sustainable opportunities for business and investment locally, nationally, and globally.
What does it take to convince private sector investors that this is a good idea, not simply because we should care about our fellow human beings who are suffering, but because it might be good for their own businesses?
I mean, this is the thing. We think about refugees as people in need, as a form of charity.
Right.
It doesn't have to be that. I mean, it's economics 101 to realize that human capital is something you can do something with, not only as labor, but as a source of ideas and innovation. Increasingly, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UN Refugee Agency, has recognized that it can't simply draw upon governments as a source of funding, then it needs to go to states, to the private sector. But in the early stages, I think the assumption was that corporations or philanthropists would give money out of benevolence, that they would write blank checks. And there was a logic of corporate social responsibility where some companies like Nike would put money in because they would want their brand to be associated with the refugee issue. And that's been great for everybody, but it has limits. There's only so much money that the private sector can give from a charitable logic. And I think there's a new realization that there's a different way of incentivizing the role of the private sector. There's a different set of motives that can draw in companies and private sector actors, which is actually a for-profit motive, but one where we can say, if we can take a basic product or process, whether it's to do with communications, solar power, street lighting, a basic idea of work like micro work that allows people to work remotely and be attached to another business, if we can take something like that and pilot it in a refugee context, well, that 42.5 million people displaced that you mentioned at the start of our conversation, that's one microcosm of the bottom 2 billion people in the world. And if you can show that a product can be effective to maintain and support the lives of refugees in that context, and that it can provide a business opportunity, well, you've got the potential to scale a product to that wider 2 billion and then potentially reverse innovate and have a product that you can sell to wider markets. So there's a very real for-profit motive where the refugee context allows us to pilot things at the bottom of the pyramid.
Okay, so let's talk about getting governments on board, because as you mentioned, many people who are warehoused for the time being in refugee complexes are not permitted to work by the laws of the host country. And there are, you know, we can look askance at those host countries, but they have some, you know, practical reasons for making those rules. Talk about what it takes to convince governments to sort of rethink their old assumptions.
Yeah. In the developing world, there's huge variation in how governments respond to refugees and the policies they adopt. The normal approach, the norm, unfortunately, is the logic of putting refugees in camps and denying them the right to work. But there are some exceptions to that, some very worthy and notable exceptions. One of those, for instance, is Uganda, where we've started doing some research. And Uganda's taken a very enlightened path of adopting what it calls a self-reliance strategy, where rather than leaving refugees in camps, it's given refugees plots of land on open settlements, quite generous plots of land, where they can grow rice and beans and maize and sell those products to market. And that's a very limited starting point. But by allowing refugees to work, you open up a whole vista of potential opportunities that can be built upon. And I think if you can start working in countries like that, and then go beyond the very basic opportunities of subsistence agriculture, and say, well, human beings have greater aspirations than just growing a few crops and selling them to market, then if you can have a few success stories, a few things that really work, then you have a story to tell other governments and say, you know what, this particular context in Uganda has worked. And not only have the refugees benefited, but the local host populations have benefited. The government has benefited. It's led to integrated development opportunities that have brought resources to the local populations. It's led to opportunities that the government has embraced for investment by companies that want to work with those refugees. If you can do that in a few places, then you can completely change the response and attitude of many governments around the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Stacy in Dallas. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate you guys bringing light to this very important issue. I know I was shocked when I realized that there are neighborhoods and neighborhoods of refugees living in our, practically our backyard, and I just never knew that they were there. But I wanted to talk about an innovative solution that we've run into, and I wanted to hear your guest comment about the International Foster Care Program for unaccompanied refugee minors.
Tell us a little bit about that, Stacy.
Well, we are actually registered international foster care and providers through Catholic Charities, but I think Lutheran Services also does that, and they identify orphaned children in refugee camps and provide them foster parents in America that they are able to stay with until they're 21. Hmm. And we don't have the children with us yet, but I just wondered if your guest knew about this program and if he had any thoughts about the pros and cons of such a program.
Well, let's find out. Thanks so much for your call.
Stacey, the program you describe sounds wonderful. I don't know about it, but it's great to hear about it. Obviously, when refugees are resettled to the United States, many young refugees come without their parents. They're known as unaccompanied minors, and they need a degree of support and protection and mentorship that they would often not have in the absence of parents. And it's crucial that nonprofits like the program you describe fill in part of that gap. In Europe, for instance, in the context I know best, we have many people who arrive as unaccompanied minors who have traveled great distances, are often extremely vulnerable, and they need that support. I mean, I know there are some great nonprofits in the Dallas area that work on providing support to orphan children requiring mentorship. One of those programs that I encountered in Uganda, which I think is a great program, is Empower African Children, which is working with Ugandan orphan children and giving them opportunities to be supported as children and throughout the rest of their lives. And it's so crucial that we have programs like that, not only for people in the developing world, but refugees who might be resettled to the Dallas area or Texas and need that kind of foster care and support. So I don't know the program you describe, but it sounds like a really terrific and important part of how we protect refugees who are here amongst us within the U.S.
And children globally make up 46% of the refugee population.
Yeah, it's an incredible proportion. And it's important to realize that many of those children not only go into exile when they're young, but often are born into refugee camps. And if you can imagine what it would be like to be born into a closed camp or settlement where your only real source of education is primary education, and then beyond that, you've seen your parents without the opportunity to work, where are the sources of inspiration that we would hope children would have to say, if you work hard, you can aspire to be whatever it is you want to be? That aspiration goes off the map if you don't see your colleagues and your peers at least getting the opportunity to go to university or to have the work opportunities that most young people would want and aspire to.
My guest this hour is Alexander Betts. He's University Lecturer in Refugee and Forced Migration Studies in the Department of International Development at the University of Oxford and Director of the Humanitarian Innovation Project. He's in town to address the Tower Center and the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity at SMU. We'll take more calls after this. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alexander Betts. He directs the Humanitarian Innovation Project established by Dallasites Hunter and Stephanie Hunt. He's in town to address the Tower Center and the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity at SMU. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Alex, how much autonomy do individual refugees typically have when the time comes to make decisions about whether they will resettle, whether they will be able to repatriate? Are they sort of told, here's what you can do, or do they get some decision in that?
Yes. In theory, at least, refugees are consulted in that process. If they've been in camps for a long time and we get to a stage where, for instance, the situation back home is changing, they get consulted. Let's say the situation has changed, the conflict has ended, a government's changed, and a population has the possibility to return home. There'll be a process that an organization like the United Nations Refugee Agency will go through, and they will communicate and explain to refugees exactly what's happened. A number of things have been piloted, like go and see programs, where a member of the community or a group might be taken back to the country of origin to have a look around and assess for themselves what's changed and shifted. And UNHCR has sort of different stages of return. They'll have facilitated return and they'll have promoted return. So facilitated return will allow people to basically assess the range of options they have and make their own choice. Promoted return will be something a bit stronger, where they'll where they'll really advocate for return. And so where you've got an ambiguous situation and things haven't improved as much as they might, there'll be a lot of choice that refugees have. However, once the balance tips and things have really improved, or the host government decides that things have really improved back home, then there might be a degree of coercion and refugees' choices might become more restricted. So, for example, we had lots of Rwandan refugees who left Rwanda around the time of the genocide in the 90s and afterwards that went across the border to the Democratic Republic of Congo, to Uganda. And quite recently, Rwanda agreed with UNHCR and neighboring states what it calls cessation, the end of the refugee process, where people had to go home. They had no choice but to return to the country of origin. That was quite controversial. Mm-hmm. Because it was seen as forcing people to go home. And with a government like Rwanda that is controversial, is a dictatorship, the safety of those people going home was often under question. Would their human rights be guaranteed when they went back home? So with return, yes, as much as possible, I think an organization like UNHCR tries to ensure people are consulted. But ultimately, when the host country decides it's time to go back, and the international community decide it's time to go back, people's choices are really restricted. And similarly, if people are faced with the option of going to a third country, like resettlement, they often have quite limited options. They can't shop between different countries and say, I want to go to Sweden, or I want to go to Australia, or I want to go to the United States. A particular resettlement country will often approach UNHCR, visit the camps, and have a quota of the number of people it's prepared to admit through its resettlement programs. And those people might be specified under criteria. They might have to have particular vulnerabilities or be from a particular part of the population. And that means that really, for resettled refugees, it's a little bit of you get what you're given. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can say, no, I'd rather stay in the refugee camp, or I'd rather wait for the opportunity to go home. But it's not as though the range of options on the menu is enormous.
To what extent is resettlement complicated by the fact that so much violence taking place in the developing world today is ethnic or religious or tribal in nature, as opposed to military or political, which can be equally devastating, but when it's over typically?
The traditional idea of a refugee is basically someone fleeing persecution. So that's an idea of targeted discrimination, usually because of something about their identity. It's because they're from a particular ethnic group, a particular national group, and there's a reason why they've been persecuted. They might be from a particular minority religion, for instance. Lots of Christians in countries like Pakistan often face discrimination and persecution as Christians. And those dynamics create knock-on effects in the ways in which people are resettled. It can create particular reasons for resettling vulnerable groups. Mm-hmm. It can mean that those vulnerable minority groups simply can't go home. With a conflict, for instance, when a cross-section of the population crosses a border, of course, more generally, they can all go home together and reintegrate. But if you're from a minority group, your situation might be very different. And so you might really need never to go back for fear that that persecution continues to exist or is recreated even amongst the dynamics of the population in exile. You can have the recreation of those tensions and those divisions between people, even in a camp-like situation. If you think about, for instance, in the war in Bosnia in the 1990s, you would have had people from the Muslim enclaves, people who were of Serb origin, leaving the country and often being reunited in refugee contexts where the potential for division was real and present. Mm-hmm. And so that means that resettlement in a way needs to target vulnerable people who simply can't go back, but that often it needs to be sensitive to those dynamics of how do we reintegrate people and which people need that kind of protection.
Are there provisions under international law for compensating refugees who can't go back but who have abandoned property?
There's almost no provision to compensate people as refugees. This is an interesting question. If people lose their property, if they leave their country of origin and real harms have been done to them, can they be compensated? And generally under international law, the answer is no. And in practice, the answer is absolutely no. What UNHCR tries to do is ensure that when people return home, when repatriation takes place, that people can reacquire their property, that they can in some ways be compensated. But that compensation and reacquiring their property is entirely based on the willingness of the government to organize that within their own national legal system. There's nothing to guarantee that people going home get their properties. But it's so important, because if you imagine a population going back after a conflict, any notion of transitional justice, any notion of healing and a sense of justice amongst communities, those that have left and those that have stayed behind, depends on a sense that people have got what was rightfully theirs,
sure.
That they go back to their homes and that they don't find another family living in the property they've left. So it becomes a very important dynamic for the sustainability of return. So UNHCR tries to ensure that with repatriation, but it's a very difficult thing to achieve. And there's certainly no guarantee of compensation, least of all for those that never go home, that leave everything behind, and in most situations will never get any of it back.
We have an email here from Ashley who writes, refugees have an array of government services, but asylum seekers get nothing while in the legal asylum process, which can take years. The U.S. has tens of thousands coming every year on visitor, student, or temporary business visas, but do not have the right to work, therefore have an overwhelmingly difficult time supporting themselves. This is a national problem that's not being discussed. While progress is being made toward the government granting the right to work, earlier to people who've applied for asylum but are sitting for years waiting for the decision while their trial draws out?
This is a brilliant question and so important. There are effectively two ways in which refugees get into any country. They can either be resettled within a formal resettlement program, or they can come spontaneously by their own means, arrive at the border or arrive in a country through another form of immigration status, and when they're here, claim asylum. Now, of course, the problem with this second path of claiming asylum when you're in the country or when you reach the border of the country is you've got to go through a very long, drawn-out, bureaucratic process to have your claim assessed. And during that process, you might not have the right to work and you will have very limited assistance. So it puts you in a very precarious position for potentially a long period of time. And asylum seekers are in a very vulnerable position. Now, a lot of governments that have a resettlement tradition view the spontaneous arrival of asylum seekers with a great deal of suspicion. They see it as a form of illegal immigration, or they see it as kind of queue jumping. Rather than waiting in the refugee camp for your turn and your resettlement ticket to come up, you've kind of jumped the queue by getting a plane in, arriving at a port of entry, or using another immigration status. But it's really important to recognize that many people come to a country like the United States in very desperate circumstances. They can still be fleeing political persecution. They can still be fleeing wars, and they can arrive as refugees, but simply find that that is the only way in which they can get access to safety. They can't simply wait in refugee camps for 15 or 20 years. They need to come by their own means. And so that route of ensuring people can arrive spontaneously, go through a process, and be supported while they're in it is a really fundamental part of refugee protection.
Going back to what you mentioned about, you know, the UN sort of doing things a certain way because they've done them that way for a long time, and to this idea of humanitarian innovation, can you talk about whether a tension exists between people who really want to follow the tried and true methods of doing things and say, we've established best practices here, and people who say the best practices aren't good enough and we ought to try something else?
Of course. In any institutional context, you have people who are more cautious and more conservative and those that are radical and prepared to be pioneers of new ideas. But I think what's uniquely problematic in some ways about humanitarianism is because it's seen as charity, there's a predominant logic where people tend to be from a certain political perspective. They tend to be liberal, and with that, they tend to have a certain set of ideas that the government has to be the only answer. Now, for me, it doesn't need to be led by ideology in any way. It doesn't need to be led by politics. The important question is, what's the best way of achieving the ends we want, which is to improve people's lives, improve the position they're in, and protect them? And there's a resistance by many people in that humanitarian sphere to the private sector, for instance, is seen with a great deal of suspicion. What's the motive? Surely the private sector are the bad guys. Well, actually, no, it really doesn't have to be conceived that way. But understandably, it takes time to persuade people who are in NGOs, nonprofits, international organizations, that there are different ways of doing things than open up to new sets of partners that might be traditionally seen as outside of that humanitarian motive. That if we want sustainability, well, the private sector might offer something new. And so we've got to overcome a great deal of suspicion that people have about new ways of trying things, whether it's new products, new processes, or simply new partners that coming to this game for a variety of reasons, but are seen as outsiders to a traditionally relatively closed area.
I wonder if you have concerns about the way these issues are covered in the media and delivered to those of us who live in the U.S. or in Europe, in prosperous societies, because it seems to me that a lot of the coverage, although well-intentioned, is very much a sort of us and them thing. It's like, here we are sitting here, and don't we look how horrible situations are there? And you don't see necessarily refugees as individuals. They are often portrayed as this sort of thronging mass in great need.
Mm. I mean, there are two ways in which they're portrayed. They're either portrayed as vulnerable victims in large groups where you don't look to the individual stories. And that can lead to a sense of helplessness where the public see these media portrayals of Syrians crossing into Turkey, Libyans crossing into Tunisia and Egypt, or Haitians crossing into the United States or elsewhere. And the response is, well, we can't help all those people. There are too many of them. It's really sad, but there's not much we can do. And I think in a way there are ways in which the media could cover those stories differently. To, yes, delve into the individual stories, but also recognize those people as having their own capacities, their own skills, their own ways of doing things, and to really champion the human story, not just of one of suffering, but one of resilience, one of seeking opportunity, and one of making opportunities for themselves. So I think there's that first risk that we portray refugees as really vulnerable, passive groups. Mm-hmm. But there's also a second risk, which is that we associate the refugee issue with an immigration problem. And this is something we really suffer with in Europe, because people have to get to Europe by themselves. Asylum is seen as a form of illegal immigration, that people are crossing borders for economic reasons. They want to better themselves, when more often than not, that's simply not the case. They're fleeing desperate situations. They're driven by the push factors back home rather than the pull factors of the countries they're trying to get to. And that means that refugees and asylum seekers are often seen with far too much suspicion rather than people that need the help and support they deserve.
Alexander Betts is a lecturer at Oxford and director of the newly founded Humanitarian Innovation Project funded by Dallasite Stephanie and Hunter Hunt. He's in town to address the Tower Center and the Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity at SMU this afternoon on refugees, technology, and the private sector. Alex, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.